This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One on Eagle Speak. Really appreciate everybody to take time out of their beautiful Sunday afternoon to join us for another edition of Midrats. And I'd like to extend an invitation for those that realize we're doing a slightly different time this week to go over and you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, and that's where you can find our chat room. That's a great place to go to roll in with the usual suspects. If you have some comments you'd like to make during the course of the show, or you have some observations you would like to share with everybody else, we'll be monitoring it during the entire show, and we will do the best to steal your ideas and roll them in as we go forward. And if you have to take off during the middle of the show and you want to see what you missed, or you want to catch up on some previous episodes of Midrats, you can always get the full archive over at iTunes or over at Blog Talk Radio. But for today, let's go ahead and get on with the show in focus. And we're going to do something a little different today. We're going to look at an area that we haven't dived into, but in one way or another, anybody that has been associated with the military has gone through wargaming of one type or another. And everybody is also aware, especially during the holiday season, that online gaming especially is very popular. But there's a great history, even in civilian games, the board games. And it's taking both that interest and some of the positive things you can get from gaming and trying to roll that and see what can we do to help make a better professional. And our guests here today have actually taken that charter and have run with it and have tried to answer the question about how you design a game that has practical, tactical applications for the naval professional. Make it accessible and understanding what type of goal can that do to not just help everybody in the fleet, but also perhaps even help those different warfare commands. And this is a project that got running as part of the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell, also called the CRIC, and the game is Fleet to discuss it. We have three with us on board. The first one is Christopher Kona. He's a warfare analyst at the Naval Undersea Warfare Center in Newport, Rhode Island. In addition to being a member of the CRIC, he's a former submarine officer, and he was a project lead for the Fleet Battle School War Game Project. We also have Paul Weber on board. He's a retired surface warfare commander, and he's also over at the Naval Undersea Warfare Center and the Mission Area Director for Undersea Warfare. And finally, if we can get him connected sometime today, last but not least, we'll have our one uniform presence here, returning guest, Lieutenant Matthew Hipple, United States Navy. In addition to his day job as a quasi-standard issue surface warfare lieutenant, Matthew is president of the Center for International Maritime Security and host of the Sea Control podcast. You can find a link to over at the show page. But today, he is primarily with us, if we can get him, as a member of the CRIC. So until Matt comes on, Paul, Chris, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Perfect. And just the kickoff question, I think I'll go ahead and roll to Chris. And the question is you always want to know when something like this comes to fruition, where does it get started? What is that initial spark? If you could just take for a moment to talk about the genesis of the game Fleet Battle School, what was that spark that led to the question, why a game? And how was the team put together to find out a good way to do that?
Thank you. So Fleet Battle School started from an article that Jason Chuma, so Lieutenant Jason Chuma and I had kind of gotten this started back in its beginnings of, as one of the Crick projects in the early days of the Crick. And he had read an article about Madden football and how some of the football players were using Madden football as a way to experiment with different approaches. And to some extent, some of the tremendous, I guess, promise that the Madden football helps you with may have been a little oversold in the article. But what it did allow is that players who played Madden football, it gave them a chance to think about the game of football and how everyone fit together and see sort of the larger picture, how all the offenses and defenses came together and how they worked. And so we wanted to try to create a way to get that kind of learning, that education about how the larger game works in naval warfare. And so it was initially billed as Madden Navy. We tweaked that just to avoid getting in too many arguments with EA at all. But the focus was to look at how do we kind of show what are these big pieces, these big muscle movements in naval warfare, and let people, let JOs, let enlisted civilians be able to pick it up and play and see what they can come up with. So part of it is learning about the warfare. Part of it is experimenting with different approaches and seeing if things work, if there's other things that don't work. And part of it too was then how do we add new things? How do we want to change some of the stuff that we have available, and does that add anything else to it? So sort of a technology aspect, if I do add a railgun or a laser or some other kind of toy that I want to see, how does that change how we really fight the battle? So we started with that. The Crick was interested in it. They wanted to see what we could do with it. And so the first thing that we did was we kicked off with trying to build a tabletop game, the pen and paper version. So there was, before we kind of knew we wanted to go for a computer game because to make it accessible, I mean, this is something that we want everyone to be able to play with, everyone to have. And it's just having a big, having a tabletop game that you can set up is kind of cumbersome. Everyone's got a computer. Everyone's got a tablet. That's really where we wanted to go with it. So, but before we do that, we wanted to make sure that we could put together to make sure the game works. So we sat down. We did it out on maps and charts with little wooden counters, and threw some dice and made sure that everything kind of fit together. And then once we had that bit working, we used that to kind of write the rules to show how the game mechanics work. And then we've been working with John Tiller Software since last spring to pull together the tablet version of Fleet Battle School. So to take that, move it onto a tablet where now you don't need to know, you don't have to have the rule book, you can just start to kind of play around with it and see what happens and go from there. And then we've been working with that. So Paul, as the lead designer, when we had gotten started, he had already done a bunch of work in trying to find ways to make the operational level of war, of naval warfare, more accessible. So how do we get the war games that we have today? We spend a lot of time doing, it takes a while. We have to set up a lot of people. It's a week-long event. There's a lot of, the adjudication is complicated, and it's not very easy for people to dive into. And so Paul Weber had been playing with a bunch of ways to make that easier to do, for people to do. So he's trying to see what's the way to boil down the way that this game works into sort of the important aspects of it without getting overwhelmed by the details. And I think Paul can talk to that in much more detail about the sort of the approach that he took as he put together this game design. But we took that idea, we took the work that he had already been doing, we got it out there, we polished it up a little bit, and we had people play through it to see what they could come up with.
Yeah, so that's a good intro.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay, I didn't mean to interrupt you. There was a long, as Chris said, there was a kind of a long germination period on this whole thing, and part of my interest in the whole operational naval of war thing came out of some work I did as a reservist over at the War College, and I was lucky enough to get involved in a project, Dr. Peter Perla, who literally wrote the book on wargaming, and he was looking at a project he called Transforming Naval Operational Wargaming. And I was at the right place at the right time. I had some good ideas. And I contributed to the CNA report with that title with some good ideas. And it, as a lot of things with wargaming, it just takes a lot of time for thoughts to kind of percolate around in your head. So I tried a number of really complicated ways of getting this done and ran them off Peter and, of course, some of the CNA guys, and their counsel was always ruthlessly simplify. So over the years, I've ruthlessly simplified and then found out that I've gone too far. Then you add complexity back and you iterate on that. And of course, everybody's got a day job, so it takes a while to do that. But the fundamental things that I came up with in all that is, in trying to keep this at an unclassified level, get away from the idea of giving, of trying to model actual real world platforms and the capabilities of those individual platforms, and look at it more from the higher level of what are the capabilities that I'm using as a task group, task force commander, trying to orchestrate all these different air, naval, undersea assets. So I broke the characteristics of the units into rheostats, I call them, and their capability levels in the game. And what we do is say, okay, for a given game, I can set the rheostat knob anywhere between 1 and 9. And there's some general relationships. So if you want to have a scenario where there's one side that has a range of capabilities down at the bottom of the scale and another set way up at the top of the scale, you can play it that way. You can have everybody in the middle, and you can see how that works. Or you can cherry-pick specific capabilities and turn them to 11, so to speak. And the point was, we do a lot of wargaming in the Navy looking at sort of, given what I have, what do I do with it? And in with the notion of kind of looking at game-changing innovation, when a lot of times we don't know how to play the game, it's one, to teach people how to play the game, and then to look at, given a situation, given a naval scenario to deal with, after playing it a few times, what are the specific capabilities that let me think differently about the problem, that to take a different approach, as Chris pointed out. So that's kind of how we've cut the knot of how do you do a modern naval game that has professional applicability but is unclassified, so that and that promotes this kind of innovative spirit that the CRIC is trying to promote. So that's where we came from, and you know, Chris had that had the good story about the Madden football, and we just happened to meet up together, and I had kind of the game idea, and he had the design idea, he had the game concept, and it's all turned out really interestingly.
It has indeed, you know. It looks trying to play the game. And I saw the hexagons. I mean, it threw me back. I'm a lot older, you guys, so it threw me back to the 1960s when I was playing, Tactics 2 on an Avalon Hill board game. And then as I moved forward, I thought, well, you know, how different is this from the Harpoon game I played in 1989 or some of the other war games? Was there a temptation to go back and recreate Harpoon, or was this intended to be completely different?
This was really
when we came out
different.
With it.
Go ahead, Chris.
Okay, so the approach that we took was trying to there's aspects of Harpoon that get into very on the detail level, and there's sort of a gap that we found in between the tactical level where you're worried about the missile movements and the ranges and how many hexes each missile has to fly and how fast it does it, and the sort of the larger level of, well, what do you really do with the ships? Where are they supposed to be? And what are the important aspects at that higher level that you have to worry about? And so we tried to, rather than sort of rebuilding Harpoon, which is a very detailed game and is very good for understanding the tactical level, how do we sort of boil that down, knowing that JOs are usually pretty solid on the tactical level, but knowing what does the destroyer do as part of the task group, as part of the theater fleet, that was the part that we kind of wanted to help it, to focus on and help explore. So in some ways we pulled this, as Paul could probably talk to, we pulled from some aspects of other games that were had good models for it, and then kind of showed how they fit together and provide effects at that higher level. Paul, do you have more?
I've worked with Chris Carlson in the past, who's one of the guys behind Harpoon, and when I worked for Matrix Games, we basically republished that. So I've worked in that Harpoon environment, and the problem that you get there is it's hard to play the game in real time more than maybe a day, even a few hours if it's a really difficult scenario, because things tend to move in accelerations of real time. Now, in the Fleet Battle School game, we've got kind of a thing where the counters kind of move incrementally across the map. For people that kind of want to watch the counter move, the way I generally play the game is where you set it so things jump hex to hex, like in those old hex and counter games that I grew up playing those as well. So the idea for this game was not to look at that tactical level of how many Sona Buoys do I put in my Sona Buoy field, or, you know, turning the ship to unmask my Sea Whiz, but it was what happens after the 3 days and I've got to go reload my ship with missiles when I start running out of fuel. We wanted to, and this is even in professional Navy war games, there's the Saved by the Bell phenomena where you go and you play the game all week and you play out a few days and Friday always comes along and, oh, by the way, you win the war, but had the war gone on another day, boy, things would have got really interesting. So we wanted to get players through those logistics cycles so they understand, you know, why a lot of the planning that goes into naval operations is important. If you play Harpoon, we joke that it's the Borg playing each other. You know exactly, you're the captain of every ship. You can give the rudder orders to every individual guy. And you can play it by the seat of your pants because you've got the SA that you know you can micromanage all your forces. Well, if you go up to the level of command where you're trying to coordinate over a larger theater and you're looking out over days at a time, we came up with this mechanic to emulate in the planning process. People talk about creating a sketch course of action and giving out commander's guidance. So we use that as kind of the interface metaphor for how people would play the game. So you literally draw with the mouse or draw with your finger on the tablet the path you want your units to go, and it indicates how long it takes for them to get there. And when you release the mouse or let your finger off, a dialogue box comes up that asks you things about, you know, how fast do you want to go? What mission do you want to do while you're going there? How much risk are you willing to assume in doing it? And it gets you thinking about orchestrating the forces, not sailing each individual ship around.
And Matt, we got you back on.
It was an aspect.
Finally get Matt. So I just wanted to kind of ask the next question to Matt then, because I think, you know, Chris, y'all really set up my question well. And Matt, the question I wanted to push your way is not from a developer point of view or from putting it together, but let's look at the end user. If you have somebody who has grown up playing games, maybe they haven't done a hex game, maybe all they've done is Call of Duty in their youth, and you got an RTC guy that majored in Phys Ed and sorority, so he hasn't been reading books for half a decade on it. What would they see having a background like everybody does of playing some game of a type, and maybe they're inside their first Sea Duty? What would they recognize with this game that would be kind of intuitive to them, and what are some of those things that perhaps they need a little more of a background to get in there to understand?
Well, thanks, Al, and thanks for everybody's patience here. I had one of those Sunday blanks, and I thought we were starting a little later, but I think, you know, Chris and Paul can carry everything on their back here. Obviously, they are real great subject matter experts here, and the reason this project has kept going as long as it has. But I like to think, you know, you guys have talked about Harpoon. and some of the other kind of games, trying to get from the complicated to the simple. And the two ways that I think of it is you look at something like Harpoon or Jayne's Fleet Command, which is going to take several weeks or days, depending how much time you have, to even get the base level of knowledge necessary, start attacking some of those operational principles Paul and Chris have been talking about, trying to communicate. And then the other side, you have something like World of Warships, which looks really beautiful, is really addicting, but really doesn't teach you that much about naval conflict. You're fighting kind of what they imagined ironclad warfare would be like, just pounding each other into dust. We're trying to find that nice middle ground where you have something addictive, you have something that looks really good, but has a few of those operational principles. And you say, you know, what are they going to need a background in? What are they trying to understand? And what we're trying to do is avoid that altogether. I give an example of something like Plague Incorporated. Nobody who plays, well, I'd imagine a large number of people who play Plague Incorporated don't understand a lot about communicable diseases. But the game is educational. The game teaches you how these things spread, even when you choose, for example, in the game, for some background, it teaches you, or rather, you play a disease that's trying to exterminate humanity, to use that maudlin example. But as you go through the game, you have the ability to upgrade yourself, and it tells you how virulent certain upgrades are. And so you're looking at this, and you're like, oh, I become airborne. And you can see, oh, wow, that's pretty effective. And so intuitively you're taught throughout the game how these diseases can work. And you do so sort of with a map of the world and kind of an operational level of war as this disease. So what we're hoping is we go in, we take the version of the game we have now. Now, a lot of it still has, you know, like Carrier Strike Group and SAG and stuff like that, terms like that. Of course, we're going to have to roll some of that language back. But what we're hoping is, you know, take fleet or, you know, you'll see guided missile destroyer, what have you. You'll be able to go into the game and you'll intuitively understand its initial interface. And the game itself will teach you those things that you don't understand. So if you're someone who's a layman and you've never really thought a lot about naval warfare, this game, hopefully, I mean, Flappy Bird can get people to black out from hunger in front of their cell phones in a lounging chair. Hopefully we can get something. I mean, I'm not looking for people to black out and die of thirst playing this game, but something that they can engage in and that will draw them into that learning process, like a lot of these games do. I don't know if the guys had mentioned while I was out America's Army, but you know, back in I think it was 2002, the Army puts out this Xbox Live multiplayer game that really engages the layman in the educational process. So you've got a lot of folks that have played first-person shooters before, and they go in, and all of a sudden they have all these other options, and there's a lot more realism involved. And I know guys that play this game, and they try to do reenactments, or they fiddle with their they use versions of America's Army where you can actually use individual radios and choose frequencies and flip over and stuff like that. They really get into it, but they're drawn in there. You know, these aren't guys that are in the Army. This is what you want to call an entry drug. So you want something like Fleet Battle School to at least initially look fun. You're like, oh, cool. Like, you know, it's a war game. This is fun. And then as you go through, for those folks that don't really understand, hey, what's the difference between a SAG and a carrier strike group? What are the capabilities that a carrier gives me, that a guided missile destroyer gives me, that a sub gives me? They understand the vague concepts. And going into this game, the game will teach them what they don't know. But that knowledge shouldn't be necessary for someone who's entering into the game for the first time.
Yeah, I thought when I started looking at it that one of the best features was that, unlike a lot of war games, you did have questions of replenishment. And somebody in the chat room already raised the question of, you know, are there admin levels? You know, do you worry about training and injuries and all that, or is that too down? Is that too down in the weeds, or is it is it really this is the chance for a young officer to get kind of that macro view of things where, you know, from 10,000 feet and see how fleet's really working, why it is you do what you do on your individual ship.
Please let me know the FITREP modules in work.
Yeah, exactly. I think we do. I think the whole concept of this game and, you know, the guys were talking about Madden at the beginning there. There's plenty of admin that you do. You get exposure to PMS. You go through InServe. You're trying to manage guys managing their work centers. We get a lot of that. And I think, what is it, Lance, Terminal Lance, you know, they were talking about, I think, what is it, a realistic first-person shooter where you spend 8 hours on watch and nothing happens in a little shack. Nobody wants to play that game. And I think to a certain point, at least the folks on the inside understand that concept. They live that concept. What we want is something that you can play in multiple iterations that will quickly teach you naval capabilities and concepts. I kind of did this at that SNA presentation last week in Hampton Roads, was I said, you know, hey, where does sports start? Kind of why did sports start? And I would make the argument that, you know, you look at the javelin toss with the ancient Olympics, you look at the at jousting, those are sports based on martial skill. And then you look at things like soccer, and you got a lot of photos back in World War I of guys wearing gas masks. You're trying to teach people how to operate as a team. So a lot of sports teach you sort of basic concepts in potentially engaging in war, depending on, you know, what arena. Like, very basic. I mean, you're not going to go go into a firefight after playing soccer, but somebody who plays that game and understands the basics of team, like, you know, engaging in a team, probably would do better from the outset than someone who's never engaged in that kind of concept. And, of course, jousting and javelin throwing, you know, if you're medieval or ancient Greek warfare, there you go. And what do we do with these games? Well, we turn those games into games. You know, before Madden first came out in 1988, there were board game versions, kind of like the board games that Fleet Battle School started in. So we're taking war, turning war into a game, and taking those games and turning those into games. And what those allow people to do, play them over and over and over and over again, just really fast iterations where the learning process happens very quickly. There's a lot of trial and error. There's a lot of openness to be able to fail. I'm not going to lose the destroyer because I'm playing around in this mobile app, and it certainly is not going to take me several hours, weeks, or potentially a year to set up a real warfighting scenario with ships or the kind of warfighting simulation that may involve an entire carrier strike group staff. You know, those are good. Those teach, you know, interstaff, teach how staffs relate to one another or how ships react in the real world. But if I want to teach someone the basic concepts, I want to give them something that they can play six to seven times in an hour and have fun with it and not even realize that they're learning. Because that's, I mean, they say practice makes perfect. And, of course, you're not going to learn how to fight a war in Fleet Battle School. But that level of practice will, at the very least, kind of inculcate in you general concepts of what these capabilities are, where you can take that one step further and maybe take that to a formal war game or bring that on your ship. And once you learn more about the specific systems and the capabilities, you'll be able to mix and match a little better in a way that you weren't at the opening. It's a lot of really good educational context for the warfighter. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Hey, Chris, let me roll a question your way. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say a few words about the idea that do we model crew status and things like that. And one of the game mechanics we have is we call them friction points. And the idea that as certain things happen in the game, you accrue these friction points that ultimately degrade your proficiency. So the idea is that you can't keep your crew at GQ for 5 days straight. And if you try to, eventually they'll start to break down. So we've got a system in the game, and particularly for aircraft, when you can try to fly four sorties a day with your aircraft carrier, but eventually your deck crews will tire and mishaps will happen, and your sortie generation rate will be high, but you'll lose a lot of aircraft down.
There's an important aspect of that, too, where it came up when you do mission planning. And so the more, as a commander, that you change your mind and try to do something else and continue to chase the shiny object in the fight, it makes it harder for your ships to plan and think ahead and stay with you. And so there's also friction point penalties for trying to micromanage your ships too much as well.
Roll a question to Chris. It kind of goes into that as well. When I was looking through the documentation for the game, I got real excited. And being over at the Undersea Warfare Center, you might appreciate this. I was like, ooh, there's a mine module here. I'll just lay a bunch of mines and these choke points. You can get a cup of coffee. This will be fun. But if you could talk about some of the different scenarios that you can utilize this game for, not, you know, the above-the-fold usual topics of a carrier strike group attack or, you know, surface action engagement, but the full spectrum of potential challenges somebody might on the tactical level or even nibbling at the operational level may encounter, that this game can help them understand the nuance and the complexity of it.
Yeah, so one of the things that we've been focusing on at the Naval Undersea Warfare Center is the use of this as a way to look at different technologies and how they might fit together. So one of the examples that we had sort of played with early was the idea of, what if you had a UUV that had a bunch of missiles on it? So it's this unmanned undersea vehicle, and those, what do I get from being able to put some weapons on it and push it out, and how many of them go where, and is that of any use to anyone? And so it lets you sort of see how that really ends up affecting the fight in the end, and does that really have an effect that you think it's going to have on an adversary who knows that you're doing it? Sometimes we talk about, especially on the technology side, we talk about how do we do is this extra radar, and we're always trying to make things quieter, or it's sensors that see just a little bit further. And at the end of the day, by playing through stuff like this, you realize that it's not really changing the decision that your adversary is making. It's not changing how he's thinking or changing the relationship. It might buy you an extra 0.3 in your exchange ratio, but is that really enough to make the change the fight, or are you really looking for something where, you know, like the mind warfare thing, now I have to think of something totally separate to go after that. I have to figure out a way to counter it, and it drags me, maybe it doesn't do what I thought it did. So it lets you look at those problems. And one of the things that we've built into this computer version is the ability to go in and change the databases and build your own scenarios and use that as a way to start to explore some of these questions. So for some, it's a way that, you know, they can put in your task group is going to go do something. So I want to go look at how do I need to do my air cover as I go into this, and where are some of the important areas to make sure I have naval air going. Or some of it may be writing scenarios to look at these new technologies. I'm going to add something here, and we're going to play through it a bunch and see, does that change how the things interact and how we're able to create that effect on red and reach some victory objective. And then some of it is building that empirical understanding of, this kind of destroyers kind of work like this, and aircraft kind of work like this, that we have been talking about before. So it gives us a chance to kind of experiment with different parts of that, and it means different things to different people. So the kinds of stuff that we do at a warfare center, where we focus on technology, will be different than you might do at a naval training center, where they're more focused on the education. But we wanted the prototype that we put together that we're coming out with in March to allow each person, these different groups, to kind of see how can we apply it to what they need to do, and sort of take it from there and run with it.
I think another big aspect that it helps you do is get an appreciation for everybody else in the world that doesn't drive carrier battle groups around. You can make scenarios where, you know, you've got, you're playing, you know, green and brown country, where each one of you have patrol boats and maybe a submarine, and your biggest ship's a frigate, and you get the feel for the technology that brings you to that next level you really understand the value it brings if you play a few games where you don't have that. You've got to play in the Marco Polo kind of game or a big swimming pool, trying to find people. Then you give people the E2 or, you know, some other kind of a sensor, and now they get a really big appreciation for what that capability brings to the fight.
I think it adds in really well to sort of concept generation. So, for example, you have something like, let's say, Air Sea Battle, or you have Distributed Lethality. You take those general capabilities, not the specific weapon systems or the specific stats, but like I said in the beginning, you're trying to take these general operational concepts and test them. You can sort of do a little bit of sort of board play with an idea like Distributed Lethality. We could add a scenario into the game, or you could make one yourself where you're using a bunch of distributed SAGs, and maybe you've got an island chain that's got a lot of air bases on it. I don't know where that might exist, but, you know, hey, let's use something that might sound familiar. And you can sort of play these things out. And then once you kind of get a comfortable idea of how it will work, maybe somebody at OpNav or somebody who's writing an article for Proceedings can sort of take that idea, take that journal play, and say, all right, let me do some research at, you know, FAS.org, or let me read some old Proceedings articles or some stuff about weapons at Boeing. And what do I think the feasibility is of this concept I just tested in the game itself? And then maybe, let's say, somebody's watching CNN or they're watching CNBC, and maybe they say see Brian McGrath on TV doing a talk in front of the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he says something. They're like, "Well, that sounds cool. You know, hey, I play this game, and I know this is like a very specific scenario, but they could conceivably go in and say, oh, I heard a lot of debate about carriers versus this distributed lethality thing, or you know, small carriers versus big carriers. Like, I wonder what that would be like in the game," and they can sort of play this out for the folks. You know, like an Alexander Clark, you know, from the Phoenix think tank over in the United Kingdom. He does a lot with SimSec, but he loves the Navy. He's never been in the Royal Navy, but it's something that he's really passionate about, that he writes about, that he engages in. His father's a naval architect, and he could hear something on the news and say, oh, I wonder how this would apply to my country or my force, the way that it's structured by my government. And he could go in and create himself a scenario, or maybe he could replay the Falklands War if he really wanted to. There's a lot of flexibility built into this game. But the great part is it starts out with that baseline, top-level simplicity, where if you are the layman, you don't have to do any of that. The passion, the real passion for naval warfare isn't required as an entry point to this game. It starts out as a fun game, just like with something like Plague Incorporated. I am not a member of the CDC, but I can sit there and I can play that game forever, and I'm going to learn, but I'm never going to look at becoming a doctor. But when someone comes up and talks to me about these concepts, I may not have the in-depth knowledge, but I won't be completely ignorant on it either. I can kind of understand what they're talking about, and I'll appreciate the topic a little bit more.
Yeah, I didn't play every scenario, but some of the scenarios I played just kicked my rear end because obviously I'm not that familiar with the game yet, but it is educational. One of the things I found fascinating, and we were talking about this a little bit with the friction points, was that there's a replenishment scenario, which as an old replenishment guy, Service Force guy, I would think, oh man, I'd be able to do that no problem. But, you know, it does take into account that if you're going to go high speed to find the oiler, your fuel level is going to go down, and it's, you know, that is an issue if you're out there running on fumes. So I thought that was really good. And I was impressed with the cleverness of the things you did include, and I wondered how you all got together and decided, you know, by the way, we need to do this and think about this issue and all that stuff. Was this many late night meetings, or is this all done through your email or you know, some chat room someplace?
So when we started down that road,
I was
we went through
saying,
and
oh.
Okay.
Well, I'm going to doff my cap. Yeah, I was going to give you guys a hat tip before you started. There is that I'm going to openly say, you know, I'm the foster father here. This was started by Jason Chuma, and it was taken forward by Captain Jerry Laidman, who's over over fighting the fight against ISIS right now. So these guys have all come together and really put this together. For me, my involvement here at the end point is putting a varnish on this thing. But these guys have really, they've done a fantastic job. I mean, I've walked into an almost finished product. So just in case anyone's confused and wants to give me undue credit for sort of being on the panel here with these guys, they've done a fantastic job over these 3 years. It's been some real hard work. Now that I've done all the brown nosing, sorry, please, over to you.
Okay. Thank you. That's great. So we started off, we got together a group of the sort of the JOs and the Crick that were gamers to begin with. And so we sat around over a couple of VTCs, and we thought through what are some of the aspects that we think are important that we want to be able to capture, what are the parts that we kind of want to downplay, where do we think that this really fits. And then working with Paul, who, like I said, was the mastermind behind the whole design piece, we sort of thought through, okay, well, if these are the things you want to do, what are the effects that we do? And then we played games. It was over the course of that first year, the reason we did that pen and paper thing, we would sit down once a week, every other week. And in large part, it was myself, Paul, and Rob Bratz up at Newark. And we'd play through scenarios and we'd try it and we'd see. And, you know, some stuff worked and some stuff didn't. We had this really great damage system in the beginning where we wanted to have little sockets that you could plug things into and they'd get hit. And then we realized that we spent more time trying to get that part resolved and figured out than we spent playing the rest of the game. And so we figured we didn't need a whole new game. So things like that. And that's kind of where we focused on initially. And then once we had what we thought was a good product, we went out, had a few groups at the fleet. We went down to EWTG land in Norfolk. We went to MPS. We played it with them out there. So we got some input on what do they think? What are the parts that resonated with them? And that's the parts that we sort of grabbed and started to build into the computer game. At some point through that, there's kind of a decision point too, where as well, this is really hard to do with dice, but with a computer, it's easy. So we'll leave that there. And then, you know, we'll make this happen on the tablet side.
Yeah, there's a lot of the graphic kind of look and feel to it. We really owe a lot to John Tiller, who I got to give some props out to. He had done a game for the Air Force with a similar kind of mission in mind called Modern Air Power. And you can actually download that in the Google Play Store if you Google on John Tiller's software in there. So we kind of, from the software side, we had a tool set to build the game from. So, I mean, in game terms, I mean, I worked with Matrix Games for, almost like 10 years. And the idea that we could start coding a game and be where we are now in under a year was, I had said it couldn't be done. So the fact that John had this head start on being able, he had the cross-platform tools, he had the basic interface framework. We were able to bring this along to where, the way it is now, it's a rapid prototype kind of thing. So, we're working on improving the graphics, improving the ease of play, improving the way the game communicates the story of what's going on to the player. And it's not like this won't end necessarily when March comes around and we kind of turn this loose out into the wild. The core people on the team will probably keep tweaking this. It's a sandbox. So once the sandbox is out there, you want to build sandcastles in the sandbox. So we see that we'll be doing a lot of development using the tools that the game gives you to create a better user experience. One of the interesting things in the game that is really unique that John brought, in most computer games, what happens under the hood is hard-coded, and once it's done, it's done. And from coming out of the computer game community where you get bombarded by the modders, the people who want to modify the game, and that's actually how Matrix Games got started, is doing mods to the old Steel Panthers game. But we wanted to sort of make this as modifiable as we possibly could. That's why there's a tool to create weapons and platforms. There's a tool to create charts. There's a tool to create the fleets, organize those, and then put them together in a scenario. The most innovative piece is we call it the rules file. And there's actually a little, we call it the window into the code. There's a file where you could go, if you know C sharp, you can actually do a whole lot. And even if you don't know how to code, there's grids in there. If you know, the old combat results table that you rolled the die and it had, you know, in those old games, attacker retreat, attacker, you know, eliminated, you can go in and you can change the percentage numbers for different results for, are things detected? What's the result of a combat? You can go in and just, I mean, you can look at the little text file and you see where all the numbers are and you go, well, I think these are too high. You know, from a training point of view, you want people to get a good feel for what the neighborhood of realistic results are. But if you're wanting to play the game and you want lots of action to happen, you can go in and change those. Or if you think we're too optimistic with how certain things are going to work, you can go on Wikipedia and you can look the stuff up and you can change it how you want it to, you know, sort of make it your own. So we're hoping that a community of people that want to do that develops after we get the main game out. And then, you know, depending on how things go, hopefully there'll be a way for John Tiller to keep adapting the way that interfaces with the rest of the game. But, you know, we've kind of tried to bake into this thing as much independent travel that this thing can take once it's released.
Yeah, Paul is somebody who back in the mid-90s got all excited when the folks who made Harpoon allowed you to customize and create your own scenarios. I think that is a great thing that y'all have given people the ability here, at least at this point, to customize and modify. And I think, as y'all mentioned earlier, you know, things that right now are programs that are just PowerPoint deep, you know, you could have things, okay, here's your best case scenario, how it'll perform, here's the negative nillies, how they say it perform, and here's somewhere in the middle, you know, how could you use it different ways. And yeah, I think that's a great feature that'll be interesting to see when you put that in the hands of the overcaffeinated JOs, what they can do with it. And I wanted to ask you a question that I've been, it's been soaking in during the course, Paul. As a recidivist staff weenie when I was on active duty, who's been 100% private sector for the last half decade, I'm real curious because you have experience there out in the civilian world with Matrix Games and working the business side of the equation. But you've also been doing the Lord's work here, working with CINSEC and the Navy. If you could talk a little bit about the years this game has developed, and I know that the CRIC operates on a little different gear ratio than most things in the Navy. But how is it taking an idea and developing it and collaborating and working with it and bringing it to fruition inside a Navy structure versus in the private sector area? And was there something that really sticks out in your mind on trying to make it work in that regard?
Well, I think one of the big things is that once you have a game company like with Matrix Games, you know, we had a fairly large customer base that whenever we came out with a new game, we had the usual suspects that were always interested in whatever the next game was going to be. So it's the dragging people kicking and screaming to play war games in the Navy is something that just never ceases to amaze me. I mean, we're up here in Newport, hop, skip, and a jump from the Naval War College, and I guess they all get burned out doing wargaming on the inside because we have a hard time trying to get just a hobby wargame group going up here on the outside. And a lot of that's because if you get guys coming from the fleet and they're, you know, trying to get some downtime, trying to get some home cooking and all that. So it's, you know, it's understandable. But I think it's really valuable how, you know, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of the Navy, they've been coming out, and if people aren't familiar with it, there's a couple interesting memos, and Deputy Secretary of Defense just had an article with the Vice Chairman talking about how important it is to engage in wargaming. And there's a whole higher-level piece within DOD where it's being promoted. And, you know, even, you know, for the – it gets back to kind of the MCPON had a thing where, you know, let's give everybody a tablet in the Navy. All the, you know, give them one in boot camp and, you know, get them things that they can do on that tablet for professional development. So a game could be a piece of that. So when we look on the inside, it's almost like there's an inertia beyond the normal acquisition inertia to get gaming. I mean, NMCI, when we Google things that have game in it, we get this splash screen that comes up and says, "Thou shalt not go anywhere gaming." I guess they think we're betting on fantasy football or something, and not Fleet Battle School. But that's kind of the thing that struck me, is that there's these, it's finally that these kind of institutional impediments to games are finally starting to be brought down from the high level. So you've got kind of the gamers at the low level are percolating around out there, and hopefully we can capture that zeitgeist. And at the same time, we're getting this leadership call to, we need more wargaming, and hopefully we can meet in the middle with this sort of a game and accomplish, you know, tasks on both sides, entertain the younger people and provide value for other people to understand how the Navy works.
So Paul talked a little bit as we went through with this about how there's a prototyping piece to it. And so in a lot of ways, when we started down this road and started talking to folks, there wasn't – no one knew what to do with this. He said, well, we want to do a computer war game. Well, why? To do what? I don't get it. Is it going to be this Unity thing? Is it going to be, you know, Call of Duty? Is it going to be – you know? And so part of this was we needed to get it in their hands. And we needed for them to have something so they could start to see, oh, this is what you're talking about. I can do this. No, wait, now that means I can do this and I can do this, and we can start to look at that. And it wasn't – without having that available – then people, you know, we're having a hard time trying to get people to understand what you can do with it. And so our principal goal with this project was to be able to deliver a prototype tablet game, computer game that you can have, and you can see at sort of, you know, this is our first blush at it, and this is how it's applicable to other things. And that's our goal for March. And so the end of March, we're delivering this game, and we're going to send it out on Windows, on Macintosh, iOS, Android, and Linux. And on all those platforms, we're going to, you can download it, you can install it, we'll have it available for everyone, so anyone who wants to use it can try it out. And it's not so much that that's the end result, but we want to help inspire people to think, well, oh, if you could do this, all I need to do is tweak it this way, or I can do something like this, and try to start to grow the dialogue over what we can do, use computer wargaming for, beyond what we're looking at.
And a big piece of that is in the Navy. When the Navy talks about wargaming, they're talking about events where you go participate in a war game. And, you know, as game players of games you go to the store and buy in a box, a war game is a tool. It's a thing. And that's another one of the tough sells to the Navy audience is, well, you go to a war game and you participate and you do it. What this idea that you have a war game that's, you know, you play it and you interact with other people playing it, it's kind of alien. There's only a few places in the Navy and in DOD, in fact, where you sit down at a table, roll out a big map, and move pieces around and roll dice. So in this case, and this gets to one of the differences with Harpoon. Harpoon, you're pretty much playing against the computer in Computer Harpoon. The James Fleet Command game that Matt brought up, you could play against someone, but the big thing we try to get to in the Fleet Battle School game is the scalability of the network part of the game. where you can essentially declare one person is the fleet commander. He can parcel out all the units on his side to other players. So we've done in our Rapid Innovation Center at Newark, we've had games where you have one guy is the commander, and you tell people, the command control is up to you. So you'll get some people that say, well, you take that half of the board, and you get all the stuff over there, and you take that half of the board, and I'll take that over there. You get the other side may say, well, I think you should take all the air stuff, and I'll take all the submarines, and Joe over there will take all the surface ships. And it's interesting how you see how people kind of self-organize to solve the problem, and then how they address the command and control issues just standing next to each other in the room, or if you're doing it distributed, doing it around logging into a server. So there's a piece of that that we're trying to get at that gets to when you play a board game, the standing around the table and talking about what's going on is a really big part of the game. So with the idea that you have people playing it on a tablet, maybe there's one guy that has, you know, his commander's screen. So sort of my vision of this in the future is you get like a horizontal touch screen, large TV sitting in a table with a bunch of guys standing around it, each one with a tablet giving commands to their part of the force. You see the little vectors and arrows show up on the map. The commander looks at it and says, yep, okay, you guys good. No, you got to go redo that. That's not what I want. And then finally he hits the submit button, and then the other side does that, and it's kind of like football. You've chosen your plays, and now the play gets run. And at the operational level for, the next couple of hours, you're standing by the radio listening to the results coming in and getting your staff guys ready so that you've got a plan for when your next OODL cycle comes up that you can quickly get the next part of your plan implemented. So that's from a gameplay point of view. That's something where we've tried to be innovative in the whole approach to actually playing the game amongst groups of people. In addition to the idea that you can, just sit and play against canned scenarios in your rack on the ship.
Well, I was going to ask that question because, there's two. There's obviously you've got a massive online version sort of scenario here, plus the individual scenarios you can play by yourself. And I was kind of thinking about the war games and the classic war game, of course, when they war game War Plan Orange, which happened to help us win a fairly major war. But is this game set up so you could do things like present Van Riper's scenario and Millennium Challenge, whatever that was? Is that doable here? And is that something you guys look forward to?
I think to a certain point. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Matt.
I was going to say, I think to a certain point, we have to realize the limitations of the virtual space this game exists in. You know, when this game started out, a lot of what Chuma and Coleman were doing was kind of tabletop stuff. You'd almost say a lot of it was kind of D&D like, and there's always the thing about Van Riper is that he broke a lot of the rules, which is good because the rules don't exist. But in games, rules exist. So you wouldn't have, if you have an innovative new idea like, hey, I'm going to get motorcycle guys to ride out on jet skis and do all these other things, maybe you could program that into the game. But I think that when we're looking at what Fleet Battle School is for, is sort of more conventional kind of concepts and capabilities. I wouldn't want to promise, and maybe the guys will say that I'm wrong here, but I would never want to promise too much. You know, under promise, over deliver. We wouldn't want to come out and say, yeah, you can test any kind of system and space weapons and this and what happens, and when really the game's capabilities don't offer you that level of flexibility. Because, even in you look at something like World of Warships, I can go in and I can test all kinds of little ship maneuvers, but I'm never going to be able to you know, test some kind of EM-style warfare because I'm driving a ship all by myself. Or if I go into Jane's Fleet Command, I have lots of options, but I don't think I would have the option of going in and saying, well, let me just add a space laser to this, because there's an entire layer of the game where you would have to add sort of like the orbits of these kinds of weapons and stuff like that. That doesn't exist. So when we're trying to train people in kind of these concepts and capabilities, we have to also understand, when it comes to gaming, the limitations of what the games can teach us, because there are a lot of things. I'll use the example. If anyone's interested, we have a new podcast at SimSA called Real Time Strategy, where we talk about this, about what you can and cannot learn from games. You go into a first-person shooter, something like Rainbow Six Siege. Yeah, maybe that'll teach people that it's really important to check their corners and stuff like that. But a lot of the incentivization is warped because you respawn and you can play again. Or if you play Diplomacy, sure, that'll teach you a certain layer of the strategic picture, but you also have to understand that there's limitations because your country is a black box. It has no internal politics. So it's important for us to realize and state the limits of the tool that we're creating. You know, you'll test you can test kind of something like air-sea battle in here, or distributed lethality, or carrier strike groups versus kind of SAGs, or maybe air wings of different fuel efficiencies and distance, or weapons ranges, a lot of that stuff. But then once you get into more unconventional warfare styles, there are ways you can test it in the game, but I wouldn't be so sure as to what you're learning, because just like what Van Riper did, is he took the rules and he just snapped them in half, and he really changed the way that the picture looked, in such a way that a programmed computer game wouldn't be able to necessarily comprehend. But that being said,
so,
let
Matt,
me
if I can
it
cut
over
in.
To Paul and Chris. Yeah.
Okay. So one of the things that we did do, knowing that there's a limit to how much we can go through, is we added an umpire mode. And the idea was, if you're sitting around and, you know, there's a limit to what you can do when everyone's remote, but if you're sitting around the table and you're having arguments about the rules, to have an umpire can sit in there and then change the results of what the die roll is. So, you know, if I come up and say, no, I have this secret cyber thing, and it totally beats your thing, and then everyone kind of nods their head, then there's a way you can do that and you can inject it into the game. So for certain cases where you're trying to do a game like that, we want to at least give you the option, and so we can use this as sort of a backdrop over which to have that argument around the table where you're really fighting over, do you think that a cyber thing is that powerful, or this EW thing will work or not, and let the people talk about it, because that's a discussion that's really rich.
Yeah, it'll keep Absolutely. The sharks with laser beams on the forehead weapon from getting into play. Well, we've already gone over, which is fine for the recording, and for those that may have joined us halfway through the show or getting on the record, our guests today have been Paul Weber, Chris Kona, from over at the Naval Undersea Warfare Warsaw Center, and also our friend Lieutenant Matthew Hipple. What I wanted to end things out here, the game, once it's all, you got everything tied up together with a nice bow on it, when is it going to be available? Where will people be able to get it? And what a lot of people are asking themselves, who is going to be able to get this game? And I guess, Matt, we can roll this your way, and then Paul and Chris, if they want to add to it, they can.
Perfect. I'll mention the sort of strategic vision, and then Paul and Chris can get into the specifics, because the game is available now for you to play, download, and fiddle around with. We are looking for beta testers. We're always looking for beta testers. We will take whoever wants to play this game and kind of red team it. But the vision of this game is to eventually get enough ownership and inertia behind it that this gets rolled out as an official sort of Navy App Store product. The Army was able to do it with America's Army. I don't see why we wouldn't be able to do it when we provide, of course, when, you know, show, don't tell. We've got a lot of tell here. We've got a lot of ideas, and we have the product, but we really have to show it. We have to show that this is app ready, ready to go on people's phones, and it works. And once we do that, hopefully that show will lead to a little bit more of a PR push behind this, in a way that To use another example, a while back, there was a program to put out an app for the Navy, and it was Peer Pressure, a pun on peer, P-I-E-R. And that was about, you know, responsible drinking, and just it was a strange cocktail of sort of very childlike games and proper lessons on social interactions. But no one's going to play that, you know, no matter how good the moral of the story is. We want to create something that actually gets to the core of that profession of arms. And once we do that, it will be hopefully available on the App Store, on Google, on Android. So anybody who's got a phone that isn't, you know, one of those flip phones that I'm sure Sal and Eagle One, you guys use, should be able to play it. But I'll turn it over to Paul and Chris here, because really you don't have to wait. You can access the game right now. So, guys.
Yeah. So I'll pass on my contact info to Sal, and we can go from there. Like Matt said, we're happy to help promulgate it now if you want to take an early look at it. And then in March, what we'll do is we'll put it out and post it, and then that way anyone in the public, whether you're in the Navy or out of the Navy, can download it and play with it and see what they can do.
Okay, great. Well, guys, again, I really appreciate you taking an hour today to join us, edition of Midrats. And, hey, whatever your holiday is coming up between now and the New Year's, I hope it's great and 2016 takes care of everybody well.
And with everybody having time off, they can play the game.
Yeah, let me throw my thanks in, guys. This is a brilliant concept, and I'm glad you guys are working on it. It's something that's very timely and certainly has been needed.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks,
and thank you very much,
that.
Everybody,
well, really
for joining us here. And we hope everybody has a great Navy Day. And until the New Year's, cheers.
Happy holidays.
All right, thank you.
Yeah.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.